Next case on our calendar is 96-2702, Hops Builders and Development Company versus Huron Builders, Inc. Mr. Zagarski.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 4 minutes for a while.
Yeah, watch your time there, clock.
Thank you. May it please the court. This appeal concerns the proper construction and application of those procedural provisions of the Ohio Mechanics Lien Act set forth in Revised Code Section 1311.06. Section 1311.06 requires a lien claimant to put forth a mechanics lien affidavit setting forth an amount due for labor or materials furnished, a property description, the name and address of the person working work or materials provided, the name of the owner, part owner, or lessee, if known, and its owner. The name and address of the lien claimant, and the first and last dates of the provision of materials and labor on the job site.
You emphasize if known. Yeah. Is it your contention that you would have been better off if you had filed everything, filled everything out, and said that we're not sure of the name of the owner?
No, Your Honor. I was merely quoting the specific provision that's at issue before the court today. Appellant will not advance any argument, particularly on the basis of the court's getting known of the statute does cover at that qualification end.
How do you overcome the problem of if you don't have strict compliance with the name? And you can put what you think is the closest thing to the name. How do you ever do a proper title search? Let's say you have a Smith Builders, and then you go put Smith Builders, you put Johnson. How will anyone ever do a proper title search?
Your Honor, appellant will not contend, nor has appellant ever contended, that there are not circumstances wherein the improper naming of the owner should preclude the attachment of the lien.
Where is that line? Where do we draw that line?
Your Honor, there are myriad situations where a trial court is required to balance the equities of the situation and to look for substantial harm or to consider whether or not the purposes of a statute or a notice or something has been satisfying. Appellant intends only that in this case, the trial court should have considered, again, whether or not the notice satisfied its purpose, whether or not any prejudicial harm would result from the respecting of appellant's lien upon consideration of those issues. The trial court would have determined, in fact, there was no showing that there was any harm or any failure of notice. And in fact, under the law of the state at 1311.22, the trial court was therefore required, respectively, as a result of the remedial character of the statute, the demand that the lien be liberally construed and the demand that substantial compliance be deemed sufficient for the enforcement of liens, appellant was entitled to the presumption that its lien would survive and be respected unless a showing could be made that some prejudice or harm would result, the avoidance of which would outweigh the beneficial intents, purposes, and results.
I can see a substantial compliance argument if, you know, you've got the acreage a little larger than it should be, or you've got the amount of lumber a little more or less than it should be. But substantial compliance on a name, that's such a jump, because the name is really what gives the lien attachment. And if you get to the name, then you're saying basically we're going to leave to the court to get to decide if that gap is close enough. But it doesn't protect all the third parties out there that rely on that search.
Your Honor, if I may, the appellant is not contending that the court should make a decision in a vacuum whether or not the name was close enough or not. appellant is contending that the trial court should consider whether or not there's any harm. As in this example, if a bona fide purchaser or valuer come along and rely on the absence of a lien in the record to take an interest in the property, then the enforcement of the lien would be wholly unjust, wholly inequitable.
But you would have to go to the lawsuit to determine that rather than be an automatic determination, correct?
Your Honor, in this foreclosure setting, that issue would be resolved. This case was a typical foreclosure action. There was a title search, there was a determination as to who had an interest in the property. They were all named defendants. The appellant was named a defendant. Its lien was located. There were no bona fide purchasers, third-party purchasers who came along in innocently and in ignorance of appellant's lien, the property who was harmed by the enforcement.
But that's this case, and as you know, we hopefully write law that gives direction to others as to what the standard is. I guess it seems to me that now and then we see cases, it seems to me that we lawyers and judges make things a lot more difficult than they need to be. Why don't we, it's not that difficult to determine the name of the owner of a company, is it? And why do we make it so difficult to say, well, but we have all these other factors that may be considered. The statute's clear. I mean, why do we make it so difficult? Why don't we just say, I mean, as we have said, it seems to me, you have to get it right,
Your Honor,
with the name at least.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, respectfully, I would disagree, and I would say that the legislature has specifically created the mechanics lien as a remedy to material suppliers and laborers. It's not supposed to be difficult. It's supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be remedial. And in fact, 1311.
But it says shall.
Yes, Your Honor, it does. And 1311.22 has a dual mandate, liberal construction of mechanics liens, and also a mandate of substantial compliance for the enforcement of liens. It's a telling position that the meaning of the word shall in 1311.06 refers to the requirement that a lien claimant file this thing, a mechanics lien affidavit. But the substantial compliance mandate of 1311.22 answers the question of exactly how perfectly does a lien claimant have to set forth all of the ingredients of the mechanics lien affidavit. Your Honor, contends that the requirements of 1311.06, the laundry list of things that need to be included in a mechanics lien affidavit, merely represent the legislature's attempt to ensure that notice will go out to everyone. There's nothing magical about any one of them in particular. And that, in conjunction with the mandate of substantial compliance, sufficiency of substantial compliance in 1311.22, results in a necessity that the trial court look to see if any harm or prejudice would attend the enforcement of the lien, especially when, again, the mechanics lien statutes are remedial in nature. They've always been acknowledged by this court to be remedial, and they are expressly made remedial recognized as remedial in 1311.22. 11. This court has stated that the purpose of the mechanics lien statute is as follows. The General Assembly, in enacting the statutory framework, intended to secure the claims of creditors whose labor and materials enhance property values, yet who might otherwise go uncompensated. This court has consistently recognized that the labor of the workmen and the material of the materialmen, having contributed to the erection of the structure, having indeed created in part the very property on which the lien sought to be attached, the purpose of the law is to give to such parties the right, when the contractor refuses to pay, to be paid for their labor and material out of the funds it's earned under the contract and out of the structure and the land on which it stands. Your Honor, this situation represents just one more where a trial court will have to take a close look at the results of, well, take a close look at the facts of the case to determine whether or not the purposes of the statute have been satisfied. And if that statute is a remedial statute, as in this case, then the court is required to respect that remedial character, to deem the statute complied with in this case, to enforce the lien. The trial court ruling, the appellate court ruling, and appellee's argument would render meaningless the provision of 1311.22 requiring liberal construction in accordance with these benefits and intended purposes, and also demanding that substantial compliance be deemed sufficient for the validity of the lien and the jurisdiction to enforce the same. This court might note that Revised Code Section 1311.22 stands apart and is unique in the sense that it is a double mandate. As set forth in Appellant's brief, there are a myriad of circumstances where the legislature has set forth a requirement that statutes be literally construed without further setting forth the mandate that substantial compliance with the statute be deemed sufficient for their enforcement. Moreover, Revised Code Section 1.42 and 1.47 statutory enactments claim meaning rules and giving full effect to all of the words used in the statute respectively apply to Section 1311.22. Appellee's argument would render 1311.22 absolute meaningless, whereas Appellant's argument does not suffer such a flaw. Does not suffer a similar flaw with respect to the use of the word shall in 1311.06. Again, the appellant does not contend that the statute could permit of utter noncompliance with 1311.06. The appellant agrees with the court that the filing of the canceling affidavit is very important and substantial compliance does not permit of utter non-compliance. And so, without a doubt, 1311.06 needs to be complied with. There needs to be a canceling affidavit filed. But the legislature has spoken with respect to the construction of that statute and as well on the question of what shall be substantial or what is necessary compliance with its provisions. The legislature having so spoken, the trial court was not permitted to apply the rule of strict construction. In fact, the rule of strict construction, as set forth in the appellate brief, at length has grown out of the lower court's misinterpretation of this court's ruling in Robert B. Platt Company versus Fox, wherein this court applied a rule of strict construction with a canceling statute only on the question of eligibility for a canceling. The question in that case was whether or not an architect could, for architectural services and design supervisory services, could an architect have a canceling? This court answered in the negative, saying that on this question of eligibility, we will apply a rule of strict construction. This is not offensive to 1311.22 because it was never the intent of the mechanics lien statutes to offer a remedy except to material men and laborers. It was for the hands-on work. It was for the actual physical material being supplied. And so the strict construction on the eligibility question, which was really an interpretation of 1311.02, not the strict construction on that eligibility provision is not offensive. It doesn't fly in the face of 1311.22. But with respect to the procedural provisions of 1311.06, having to do with, you know, getting these elements of contention set forward, substantial compliance is, by legislative enactment, made the standard. There was no harmful result. There was substantial compliance. And the trial court was not, therefore, free to set aside this thing. Court has any sort of questions for me at this time. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Zagarski. Mr. Dunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to first introduce the Chief of Counsel today with Tim Annual, attorney in our office, and Rachel Kaska, who has written briefly with the Indian Security Act, and Title Association. I'm going to be brief because I believe that you do your written work and you say what you have to say, the written work and present what we have to say. The principal theme I guess I want to communicate here is that the mechanics lien is very special privilege. And it's a privilege that's afforded particular groups of people in Ohio, but not most Ohioans. If you or I owe $20,000 on a promissory note, we cannot slap a lien on the obligor's property and use that as a club to get paid. We have to do what everyone else has to do, which is hire a lawyer, perhaps go to trial, pay a lawyer, get a judgment, file a judgment lien. If a doctor saves a life in Ohio and does not get paid, that doctor cannot slap a lien on someone's property and get paid through that. He has to do the same thing.
With the listing of an improper name on an affidavit for a lien be quantitatively more important than an improper legal description that had three or four words left out but still was properly indexed for title searchers to find?
I don't profess to be a real estate lawyer. I've never been in a county reporter's office in my life, but I believe that it is a difference because of the way titles are searched.
So in other words, we would find under liberal construction, under the latter example, three or four words left out of the legal description but properly indexed, substantial compliance.
I agree with that.
Statute says you shall have a clear, the exact legal description.
I think if all this case was about was the Burke Lumber saying in their mechanics lien affidavit, the current building company, I don't think any trial court would have invalidated that. I think under 1311.22, even though it says you name the owner, I don't believe we would have been even at the appellate court with that issue, because I don't believe any trial court would invalidate it. It's a part of the story, I believe, Your Honor, when you name an individual instead of a corporation. I mean, we learned in first year corporations that there's a distinction between individuals and corporations in the law. And that distinction in the law is simply ignored in this case by Irvin's argument.
Did the lien get indexed to the proper piece of property?
I believe that it did.
So whoever was filing it seemed to have understood what the lien was.
There is no doubt that the lien was found. I mean, the amicus points that out as well. The fact that it was found, though, doesn't validate the lien. There's nothing in 1311.01 to 1311.22 that says you can violate all the procedural requirements of the lien statutes. But if the lien is found, it's a valid lien. There's nothing there. In fact, in the Second District, one of the cases we cited in the Second District was a Second District case called Brown v. Pearson. And in Brown v. Pearson in Champaign County, the property owner actually went to the county recorder's office and looked up the lien. He found the lien there and saw that there was a lien. However, the lien had not been properly served by the supplier from Pearson. And the Second District in that case held that it doesn't make any difference if this man went to the county recorder's office and knew that there was a lien on his property, because the supplier and material man had not complied with the statute, the lien was invalid.
How was your client operating his business? Letterhead,
signage, those kinds of things.
Pardon me?
How is your client operating his business, letterhead, signage, those kinds of things?
My client's my law firm.
The owner of the property.
I have no idea. I believe it was Current Builders, Inc., but I don't know, in terms of signage and things and business cards and things, I honestly don't know. What I know is it was a corporation called Current Builders, Inc., and that's the corporation that owns the property on which this lien was sought in place.
When it is properly indexed and all of those things, it might not be appropriate for a court to look at that kind of thing. In other words, if the supplier was actively misled or had no reason to know of the existence of the corporation, this person always came in the store, ordered, didn't have any signs on the truck saying anything about the corporation, checks that had been paid for previous supplies didn't indicate that. Should that make no difference?
I don't know that it makes no difference. It's certainly not set out in the plain statutes, Your Honor. As a practical matter, the trial court going to consider that? It might. I don't know. The canceling law has developed such in Ohio over the last 80 years that trial courts look at the statute and look to see whether the statute is complied with. This court for 80 years has told Ohio judges and Ohio lawyers that you must comply with the procedural requirements of the mechanics lien statute, or else you do not have a valid mechanics lien. And that goes back to what I began with in the first part of my argument, which was that this is recognized as a special privilege that is given to suppliers of material men that is not conveyed to most Ohioans who, when owed debts, have to hire lawyers and sue people and get judgments. And our whole point is this. It isn't too much to ask, and it shouldn't be too much to ask of a person who has been afforded this privilege that they do it right, and that they make the phone call to the county auditor's office. I mean, we're at the Supreme Court now, and nowhere...
What are you going to find at the county auditor's office?
They can find out who owns the property.
I thought you found that out at the recorder's office.
The auditor's office or the recorder's office. You can do it in a phone call. As I was about to say, we're here at the Supreme Court, and no one has ever explained, why are we here? Now, how difficult is it to pick up the phone and do this right? To make the argument that we didn't do our jobs, we didn't do it right? I don't know.
Would your mortgage be superior in time to that of the lien, if the lien were valid?
No.
Yours was a second mortgage, though. Were there other intervening liens?
There were liens behind ours.
And other than the first mortgage, any prior to yours?
I believe the mechanics lien was after the first mortgage.
You believe what, sir?
There was a mortgage and then the mechanics lien. And
this mechanics lien, but no other mechanics lien or material men's lien?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, so you're second in line.
Yes,
probably.
One point about 13106 that I think is significant, and I point this out in brief, is that the statute does say specifically that the inaccuracy of any address in the affidavit does not invalidate the lien. And what I argue in the brief, and I'll argue to this court today, is that if the legislature had intended that the inaccuracy of a name similarly not be grounds to invalidate a lien, it could have easily said so in the very paragraph that said that the inaccuracy of an address does not invalidate the lien. What the appellant is asking the court to do is set aside literally about 80 years of common law that this court has set forth, beginning with Mahoney Park Company, Warren Home Development Company, a case that was decided 7 years before C.C. Constance and Sons. to set aside 80 years of common law where judges, trial courts, and lawyers all around Ohio have been guided by this common law on the basis of this case because a supplier failed to name the right person, I think would be a big mistake. And I think the amicus brief of the Ohio Land Title Association, if I didn't say another word here, if you just read that brief, I think it would convince the court that on policy grounds alone, this case should not be reversed. We respectfully request the court to affirm the court's opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Mr. Zagarski, you say 3 seconds, but you can take 30 if you like. Yes, it does. You have 3 seconds left, but I'm giving you 30.
This court should not be persuaded that counties arguing this court should turn over 80 years of common law. Mahoning was a 1924 case, CMC Constance was a 1930 case, and this Supreme Court case, this court case, Robert B. Platt Company was a 1931 case. Every case that this court has ever handed down that that had a rule of strict construction was based on the common law rule that statutes in derogation of common law get strict construction. That rule, as to remedial statutes, was legislatively overruled by this court in 1953, passage of the revised code, and revised code section 1.1. That rule is specifically overruled, and cases like Mahoning in 1934 and CMC Constance in 1930 had absolutely nothing to offer this court in the way of authority. Again, and also Platt, again, was on the issue of eligibility. For that reason, the council respects the request that this court correct an ongoing mistake in the court that has been going on for the last 8 years, not to overturn 80 years of U.S. law.
Thank you, Mr. Zagarski. This case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Next case is 97-1231, State of Ohio Electoral, Stephanie Tubbs-Jones versus Honorable Ronald Suster. Five counsel who wish to argue with 15 minutes aside, I would urge you to be as concise as you can if you'd like to give your co-counsel an opportunity to argue. The first person is Ms. Tubbs-Jones.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Stephanie Tubbs-Jones, and I am the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor. I want you to thank you for granting our request for oral argument and for the alternative written prohibition. I'm assisted today by the head of my appellate division, George Sack, and Marilyn Cassidy, a member of my civil division. I ask that we be permitted to divide our argument as follows. I will address the issue of statute of limitations. Ms. Cassidy will discuss a wrongful incarceration and the statutes and case law, and we will reserve the balance of our time to allow Mr. Sand to do the vote.
Well, let me ask, who's going to argue why a prohibition action is appropriate here?
Both myself and your
own. Okay, good. Thank you.
Justices, as relayer, I seek to prohibit the Court of Common Pleas and Judge Ronald Suster from proceeding further in this action. Why? Because the statute of limitations has run. No matter which statute you choose to apply, time is up. This action is barred, time ever.
Is that a jurisdictional issue? I guess let me tell you the problem I have with the relator's briefing is I think you've made some, to me, somewhat persuasive arguments on the merits, but I don't see a strong argument on why prohibition applies here. Prohibition meaning that the trial court has no jurisdiction to hear the issue that's before it. And as you know, we've written on this a number of times. I guess I'd take you my first question would be, is that, as you know, we have dismissed prohibition actions now and then because of latches, because the action hasn't been brought early enough in the proceedings. It seems to me that that's an issue that needs to be addressed here.
Your Honor, if you go to the facts of this particular case, keep in mind when Sam Reese Shepherd or Alan Davis filed this complaint, they filed it under the criminal number. This is a civil action they seek to bring at this time. It was almost a year before we were able to convince both the court and the counsel for Sam Reese Shepherd that they needed to bring a civil action. Once the civil action was brought, we then awaited a decision by the court with regard to jurisdiction. Once this court made a jurisdictional issue or ruling with regard to whether the statute of limitations had passed, and keep in mind that the ruling of the court was simply that our motion to dismiss was denied. The court was not clear on the basis upon which they denied our motion to dismiss. We were in seeking a writ of prohibition less than a month after that determination was made. And so if you follow that line of facts, then it is clear that we did not sleep our rights in bringing the writ of prohibition to you. We seek the writ of prohibition here because we think the law is so clear that the lower court cannot even proceed.
The concept. The chief has already opened up. What's to keep every litigant who feels they have a slam dunk win from coming right to the Supreme Court to cut down the cost of additional litigation? Why have to deal with the trial court or court of appeals? Why not just bring everything to the Supreme Court if you think you have an open and shut case?
What you have to look at, Justice, are the law and the facts in this particular case. We're looking at a situation where a case is 50 years old. The law, statutorily, legislature, nor court could contemplate that I should be required as a prosecutor to litigate a case that began when I was 5 years old. You have to contemplate the reason statute of limitations were instituted. Because memories fail, witnesses die, evidence gets old.
But that's all.
And therefore,
that's all merits. And so,
but the law is very clear that even wherein a court has determined jurisdiction or has not even determined its jurisdiction, if it is patently and unambiguously clear that it is the statute or the case is barred by statute of limitations, prohibition lies. And that's the argument we're making to you, that there is no jurisdiction in the lower court and that you, there's no adequate remedy in law for us. And therefore, we come to you. We know this is an extraordinary writ. We recognize that in granting what we ask of you, it is an extraordinary for you to step up. But this is an extraordinary case.
Well, why is an adequate remedy at law not an appeal from a decision by the trial court that the statute of limitations doesn't apply here, that this is a good case, and so it proceeds, and you don't like the decision, you can appeal, can't you?
Accepting justice, the case law is very clear that the fact that an adequate remedy of law by appeal exists is immaterial wherein jurisdiction does not lie with the court, wherein it is clear that the lower court cannot or is barred from hearing the case. And that's the argument we seek in prohibition.
So you would say anytime it's clear that the statute of limitations bars a claim, that means the court has no jurisdiction and prohibition should lie. I think that's the argument. Is that the legal argument that you're...
That's one of the legal arguments we make to you, Justice. And because you told me that I have to be short in my time to allow my assistant to give you an argument...
Well, I know that was futile, but I said it anyway.
I tried to be short, Justice. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to move to allow Ms. Cassidy to proceed with our arguments.
Ms. Cassidy?
Ms. Cassidy, you couple your argument with the prosecutor's argument, do you not, on the basis that the court unambiguously and patently lacks jurisdiction, not just because the statute's run, but because there's a plaintiff that doesn't exist?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's the state's position that the wrongful incarceration statute, by its explicit terms, reflects the legislative intent that living people should make these claims, that the wrongfully aggrieved individual, the wrongfully incarcerated individual, which is the language that appears in the statute, is in fact the person who should bring the claim. And we feel that this is crystal clear within the statute, and it's repeated throughout the statute.
Why would we not permit, or why, assuming the prohibition, we get over that hurdle, why would you not permit substitution of the fiduciary for that of the deceased real party in interest?
Under this set of facts, Your Honor, the deceased individual, Samuel H. Shepherd, never attempted to pursue any type of remedy in his lifetime. 1966, when he was released from prison, through 1970, when he died, he had oral claims available to him. He made no attempt to claim any redress.
But we
on
permit,
his own behalf.
But we permit substitution in other cases where, during the pendency of litigation, or even while litigation is impending, the substitution of the fiduciary for the real party. Why is that? Why should this case be different? And is it because the statute says the individual?
Our position, Your Honor, is that the legislative intent is clearly demonstrated within the language of the statute, that it is not within the purview of the court to extend the operation of the statute by including representative parties, heirs, and assigns.
Wouldn't we have to rewrite the statute to allow substitution of parties?
I think perhaps substitution may be permissible, for example, in the case which Mr. Schwartz, I believe, cites Celestino, where the individual was alive and at least attempted to assert a claim during his lifetime. During the pendency of the litigation, the plaintiff died. It seems appropriate in those instances where at least an attempt was made on the wrongfully incarcerated individual's behalf to assert some claim,
Where would that authority come from? It's certainly not in the statute.
There is ample authority, at least in federal law, specifically Kerner, which shows us that a claimant is 13 years old, where the estate came and attempted to make a similar claim under similar facts. The court did an analysis and found that the administrator of the estate did not fall within the scope of the protected group, that a right such as one in wrongful incarceration is a personal right, that only the individual whose rights were violated can be the individual to bring the lawsuit. And for those reasons, the administrator not only was an improper party, but lacked standing.
When do you claim that the statute began to run?
Your Honor, it's my position, the state's position, that the statute began to run at the time that Mr. Shepherd was released from prison in 1966. And under the most liberal analysis, since the statute was not in existence then, we can say that the statute, we can even spot him in 1986 when the wrongful incarceration statute was enacted.
What statute applies? How long a period of time?
Your Honor, we believe that this court has ruled that the wrongful incarceration statute does not replace but rather supplements the wrongful imprisonment tort, false imprisonment tort.
How long?
That statute is 1 year, Your Honor.
1 year. But doesn't the statute require a determination by a court that a person was unlawfully imprisoned before the statute starts to run?
It does, Your Honor, and that brings us back to the initiation of a civil proceeding. The declaration can only be acquired by initiation of a civil proceeding. Civil proceedings, in the state's opinion, are subject to statutes of limitation.
So you don't need a determination by the common pleas court that you were falsely imprisoned before the statute starts to run?
No, Your Honor. Our position is that the statute of limitations, meaning the wrongful imprisonment statute of limitations, would begin to run when the action accrues, that being when an individual is released from incarceration.
Are you saying then that the second trial in which he was found not guilty and then his subsequent release from prison
in 1966
triggered the applicable statute to be used here?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why are not all of the issues to which you just referred not legal issues that can be determined by a trial court? Why does a trial court not have jurisdiction to determine, to apply, interpret the statute with respect to who a proper party is and survival claims? Why is that a prohibition action?
Your Honor, I believe that the main issue here goes by several different names. And the reason is that the statute of limitations creates a clear time bar. This is not a case where we have factual questions about someone discovering a hemostat in their side on an x-ray 15 years later and then begins to file an action outside of what might ordinarily have been the statute of limitations. In addition, the law tells us that this is a personal type of action, that these are personal rights which were violated, personal only to the wrongfully incarcerated individual.
So a new grounds for prohibition, I guess, I think it would maybe take out new, but a grounds for prohibition action would be that personal rights have been extinguished or somehow are attempting, there's an attempt to recreate rights that are personal. That's a grounds for prohibition.
That's one ground for prohibition.
Is that a new ground in your mind, or is that?
Your Honor would be standing.
Counsel, we've held that standing isn't
an issue.
It just last in 1996, we said that standing doesn't attack, and it's properly raised for post-judgment appeal. And clarity, the other issue everybody keeps saying is just the law so clear. Since when is clarity of the law a basis for an extraordinary writ? Extension limitations are raised as an affirmative defense in many cases.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And even if they're how clear, you know, they're the clearest of clear, does that mean that the court doesn't lack jurisdiction or lacks jurisdiction to decide, rightly or wrongly, the issue of whether or not the statute is run?
We believe in this case, Your Honor, that it does deprive the court of jurisdiction, in addition to the other arguments that have been set forth.
Do you have any case that says that? The clear running of statute of limitations entitles a movement to an extraordinary writ in prohibition.
Not the simple passing of the statute of limitations, it is the passing of the statute of limitations in addition to the explicit language of the wrongful incarceration statute.
All you're saying is the law is against them. It's really against them. That's your argument. Do you have any case that says anything even close to that?
Your Honor, I rely heavily on this court's own decision in Bennett that says that wrongful incarceration does not replace wrongful imprisonment that supplements it.
But that's not you haven't addressed the issue of the procedure. That's what I'm inquiring about, the procedure that you've employed here, which is seeking a writ of prohibition. That the case, Bennett case, does not help you there, does it?
Your Honor, it's our position that we have no adequate remedy at law, that the endurance of a trial and appeal.
But we've held, as the Chief Justice points out, we've held many times that the endurance of a trial does not amount to an inadequate remedy at all.
Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You may answer if you like, but you don't have to.
I would simply reiterate that it is the totality of the facts and circumstances in this case, which are not ordinary, but are extraordinary, and that is why we are seeking an extraordinary remedy.
Thank you. Mr. Schwartz.
Okay, please, the court. My name is Mickey Schwartz. I represent the Honorable Ronald Suster and the Court of Common Pleas, Cuyahoga County. with no interest in the outcome of this case. Accordingly, we have agreed to split our time with Amicus Curiae, which is the Shepherd's estate, without necessarily endorsing everything that might be argued by Amicus. And parenthetically, before beginning, I might express my sympathy for lawyers required to argue a Mechanics Lien Act case immediately before Shepherd. What happened here is pretty clear from looking at the record in the trial court. And you'll see that after the civil petition was filed on July 24 of 96, the prosecutor filed a motion to dismiss on August 9. And that motion to dismiss is at tab 5 of our evidence. It's expressly denominated a motion to dismiss on grounds of Ohio Civil Rule 12b-6, the failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And it argues standing, latches, statute of limitations, abatement by death, and never utters the word jurisdiction or mentions 12b-1, of which pertains to jurisdiction of subject matter. After that motion was denied on January 13, 1997, they filed an answer on February 28, engaged in various aspects of motion and discovery practice, and only then on May 7, 97, some almost 10 months after the civil action had been filed, did they file a motion for judgment on the pleadings, tab 14 of our evidence, which makes the exact same arguments and cites the same authorities, but this time calls it jurisdiction.
Maybe some court along the way would have said you have to exhaust those kinds of procedures before an original written prohibition will lie.
Well, I think the point is that these issues were not perceived to be jurisdictional when filed. And only 9 months, 10 months later, were they refiled and called jurisdictional in order to have a claim basis then for seeking prohibition from this court.
Well, wait, motion to dismiss on the basis of running the statute of limitation is clearly jurisdictional.
It's clearly not jurisdictional, according to Mills' case decided by this court, which holds that the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense that is waived if not asserted. And subject matter jurisdiction can never be waived. So clearly, statute of limitations is not a jurisdictional defense.
But it comes down to jurisdiction. The court doesn't have jurisdiction if the statute is run. Isn't that correct?
No, that's not correct.
So you say that the trial court can proceed, you set it up as an affirmative defense, and correct it on appeal.
I'm saying the statute of limitations is not a defense that patently and unambiguously deprives the court of jurisdiction, or deprives the court of jurisdiction at all, and the remedy for a perceived erroneous ruling is appeal and not writ of prohibition for want of jurisdiction. Similarly, this court has held, as Justice Cook indicated, in not only State Exrel Smith v. Smith, but also State Exrel LPG Steel v. Wynn, that standing is not a jurisdictional issue that justifies the filing of a writ of prohibition. And the state can offer no cases that support the issuance of writ of prohibition on those grounds. In fact, with respect to the statute of limitations, I will call your attention to the fact that the legislature obviously considered the question because it imposed a 2-year limitation on seeking the money damages after the declaration of innocence, but imposed no limitation on the finding of the declaration of innocence. With respect to standing, the state relies heavily upon the distinction between an individual and person. However, person and individual are used interchangeably in the statute. In person is used once in B1, three times in B3, and in Section 3 of the Act regarding eligibility, regarding timing. This court has rejected two previous attempts to limit the Act based on very fine distinction of the language, the differences between crime and offense, the differences between action and civil action in Walden. And it has been held by the Franklin County Court of Appeals in the state of Larry that upon a person's death, the state becomes its personal representative for all legal purposes. And thus, the administrator of the estate was held to be, quote, an individual concerned, unquote, within the meaning of Section 145.27 governing access to certain PERS records. So even if, with respect to statute of limitations, even if there is a statute, the question of when it arises, when it begins to run, requires evidence and factual determinations that are not possible on this record before this court. I think the court starts down a slippery slope. If it grants a writ of prohibition here, it will invite every 12B6 movement loser to seek review in this court and present much greater floodgates problem than this 50-year-old case, which has attracted this interest, which is unprecedented, with one possible exception in this century.
Counsel, should we find a way to have a mechanism when someone brings litigation that's going to be protracted and involves a great deal of time and effort on part of those who are having to defend it, in which all sides of the case, as it's advanced here, statute of limitations problem, question of whether or not anybody has a right to bring an action, whether or not there is a statute even applicable to any sort of effort to recovery. Every facet, new ground to be plowed, and to arguably on the side of the prosecutor is advancing on the face of it. No claim, nobody to make a claim, and out of time, if there was, should there be a mechanism to get such a case to the state's highest court, who's ultimately going to have to say, you can do all of these things to circumvent the, that seems to be the underlying issue here, that this is going to be protracted, expensive, and ultimately lead nowhere.
Well, those are assertions by the prosecutor.
I understand that. I understand that.
Perhaps there ought to be some kind of procedure, but the stare decisis of this court doesn't allow for it. And I would cite you to the case of Wentler versus Enright, in which this court denied a writ of prohibition to someone who was claiming that it was double jeopardy, that they had a constitutional right not to go through a second trial. The court said, too bad, you've got to go through the second trial and take the appeal. So I don't think that there's any basis in this court's present jurisprudence for the relief sought by the prosecutor. I would yield the rest of my time to the witness.
Thank you. Mr. Gilbert.
Chief Justice, my name is Terry Gilbert, and excuse my cold, I am such a flu. I represent the estate of Samuel A. Shepard. And the point that I want to make here this morning is that this estate is not just some ambiguous legal entity or legal fiction. I mean, we have an actual victim here of injustice that, while occurring over 43 years ago, it continues till this day. The estate of Dr. Shepard is a son, a surviving heir to the estate, whose mother was brutally murdered while he slept in the next room over in 1954. He's also the son of the man who spent 10 years in prison for a crime which we believe and which we can prove in a court of law in today's evidentiary climate that he was innocent of those charges. And if our contentions are correct and true, then a statutory proceeding which is designed to correct such injustices with respect to victims of wrongful imprisonment, then that remedy should be given the broadest and most liberal construction that this court can provide. According to Revised Code Section 1.11, remedial statutes must be liberally construed to assist the parties in obtaining justice. And it should not matter in the scheme of things whether that wrong occurred 43 years ago or last year. The prosecutor has brought up the fact that Dr. Shepard should have been in a position to seek a remedy as soon as he was acquitted in the second trial in 1966. Well, we all know that under the statutory scheme, it is incumbent upon the claimant to prove through affirmative evidence by preponderance of the evidence, according to the Walton case, that he's innocent. It's not sufficient to just have an acquittal. And what we are saying here is that the evidence that liberates Dr. Shepard from the yoke of being found guilty was not obtained until many years later. We started this campaign 7 years ago in revisiting this case and examining every piece of evidence. We had to go to this court on a petition for writ of mandamus to get the police files, which opens up the door to evidence that shows deliberate concealment of exculpatory evidence of his innocence.
Well, the prosecutor makes a good argument, and I've been a part of the law of this court that applies prohibition very strictly, because I think it is a special writ. But she raises an interesting point that I think Justice Pfeiffer has touched on, should we really change the law of prohibition? Should there be a provision for a case where it seems, at least on its face, that a party has no right to a claim, has no, for whatever reason, statute of limitations, because the claim doesn't survive. In the interest of judicial economy, what's wrong with filing a prohibition action in a Supreme Court or a Court of Appeals to have that issue determined so that there is not, in this case, obviously if it goes forward, it's going to take a great deal of resources because it is novel. What's wrong? Should we not consider, I assume you would argue that we should not, why should we not consider an exception, a stretching of the prohibition rules a bit?
Because the jurisdiction in this particular case is granted to the Court of Common Pleas to consider whether or not an individual fits within the framework of a wrongfully imprisoned individual. We give the gatekeeping function of resolving these issues to the lower courts. The fact that the state of Ohio comes in and says it's going to cost them a lot of money to defend this case, that the evidence is stale, that the case is too low, are mere assertions without any backbone. We are private people who were able to develop over 7 years evidence of innocence. We presented it to them, we handed it in their lap. Everything is there. It's up for the court to decide whether our case has merit. We cannot allow, as Mr. Schwartz indicated, every litigant who comes in and says it's a novel issue of law or an interesting case or something that is unusual, and have the Supreme Court of Ohio come in and say, let's stop it in the interest of judicial economy. I think that would wreak havoc on the system of justice that has served us well for so many years.
But there are many causes of action that statutes have run, and then they discover that they had the evidence to go forward with it, but it was too late. Why should we make an exception for you? You stressed that because of the new technology, you just now determined that you had evidence. But there are many statutes that run, and people don't have the evidence, but to find the evidence after the statute is run. Why should we make an exception to you?
Because I think, number one, the statute in this case implies the issue that you raised earlier, that oftentimes the evidence is not there at the point of acquittal, that it takes some later act or disclosure or revelation that frees the individual from the wrongful imprisonment.
But the statute doesn't say upon discovery of evidence sufficient to go forward, does it?
The statute is silent, Your Honor. The prong that we're dealing with in the Common Pleas Court, 2305.02, makes no reference to statute of limitations. It is the 2743.48 prong.
But it doesn't prolong any statute that may be running until you get the evidence either.
It does not prolong the statute, but the statute, we're saying there is no statute.
There is no statute, you say, on this case.
We say there's one
of those cases that doesn't have a statute.
Well, we say that this is one of those peculiar areas where the state legislature has put the statute of limitations in, specified it in the act itself, and that is 2 years subsequent to a court of common pleas making a determination of that the person is a wrongfully imprisoned individual.
So then you feel that you can go to the court at any time that you feel you have evidence to fulfill the showing an unlawful imprisonment.
That's correct. But I would submit to this court that a discovery rule would be in the interest of all parties concerned. And in this particular case, we acted expeditiously in bringing the action as soon as the evidence emerged. And if you look at the studies that have been coming out recently, the Justice Department, the FBI, that 25% of all the people that are in prison on the sexual assault crime, for example, are later found to be innocent because of wrongful conditions, wrongful IDs, or as we've seen through the use of DNA technology.
I noticed the light is on and you've answered my question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. You used your time. Mr. Saad, your co-counsel used all your time, but not by very much, so take 30 seconds. 30 seconds.
30 seconds, quickly. I'd like to refer this court to Massey versus Kerner. In that particular case, it establishes what we feel is the correct application of law. Next, I would like to say that with both defendants, Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Schwartz, are saying is very simply to this court that any representative, legal representative, can file an action for wrongful incarceration despite the absence of many, many years. This is truly not the legislative intent of that statute. Sam, Shepard, Cook have filed that action at any time. I didn't hear Mr. Schwartz comment about one word that between 1966 and 1970, why Sam Shepard did not file. If Sam Shepard chose not to file, why should this court give the legal representative the ability to file the case? And most strongly, I deny any allegations on behalf of the county prosecutor's office that Mr. Gilbert told this court that we delivered the concealed evidence in this particular case. Nothing is further from the truth.
Mr. Saad, how do you get around the second prong of prohibition that the trial court is clearly and patently without jurisdiction?
This court, the respondent court has no jurisdiction. We get around to Justice Douglas by two obvious means. Number one, we have no adequate remedy of law. And number two, there's also another test of the writ of prohibition.
Oh, wait.
And that test
is
irreparable harm to the state.
Wait, the third prong is no adequate remedy of law. We have to do all three. That a judge is about to exercise judicial jurisdiction, that in fact he or she is without and patently without jurisdiction, and that there's no adequate remedy at law. I only want to know about prong two.
Well, you go to prong two by just the absolute statute of limitations. It's just crystal clear in its face that almost 50 years, nearly a half a century later, is about to exercise jurisdiction on a case that has long since died.
So you say the trial court is patently without jurisdiction because, one, the statute of limitations is run, and two, because an individual must bring the action, not a representative.
That is correct.
All right. Does a trial court determine that, or should that be determined in one of the great writs?
That's determined in the current case.
Well, was the current case a prohibition?
No, it was not. It was a writ of court, and all this, the same principles apply. Kerner was a federal appellate judge, Justice Moyer, and he was accused of taking a bribe. He was then subsequently convicted, later reversed upon appeal. 13 years later, like in this particular case, his son came forward and said that we want money damages for the wrongful incarceration. The Federal Court of Appeals up in the Chicago area, which is one of the most prestigious districts, comes forward and says the state has no standing to bring the action. They said that Kerner's rights is a personal right, just as Shepard's right is a personal right. And if the right was not given to Shepard to exercise, how can we say that 40 years later that we're going to permit somebody by the name of Alan Davis to come in on behalf of the estate and say, give me the money? And that's what this is all about. This is about fundamental justice for the residents of the state of Ohio. What do we do as a court? What do we do when the legislature says this applies to an individual who has suffered collateral disabilities? Are we going to say, oh no, that's not the case. Anybody can come forward here and not file these actions years later? That's not really what the legislature
says. You've used your 30 seconds, Mr. Saad.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal will please adjourn court.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Office of Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.
Thank you.